Resupply would have to be ferried across the way it had always been, in ugly, fat, slow merchant ships. Targets. Maybe the merchies weren't so slow anymore and were larger than before, but there were fewer of them. During his naval career, the American merchant fleet had fallen sharply, even supplemented by these federally funded vessels. Now a submarine could sink one ship and get the benefit it would have achieved in World War II by sinking four or five. The merchant crews were another problem. Traditionally held in contempt by Navy sailors, a truism in the U.S. Navy was to steer well clear of any merchantman, lest he decide to liven up his day by ramming you. The average age of the crews running the ships was about 50, more than double that in any American naval vessel. How would those grandfathers take the stress of combat operations? Morris wondered. They were quite well paid. Some of the senior seamen made as much as he did. But would their comfortable union-negotiated salaries devalue in the face of missiles and torpedoes? He had to erase the thought from his mind. These old men with kids in high school and college were his flock. He was the shepherd, and there were wolves hiding under the gray surface of the Atlantic. Not a large flock. He had seen the figures only a year ago. The total number of privately owned cargo ships in operation under the American flag was 170, and averaged about 18,000 tons apiece. Of those, a mere 103 were routinely engaged in overseas trade. The Supplemental National Defense Reserve Fleet consisted of only 172 cargo ships. To call the situation a disgrace was to describe gang rape as a mild social deviation. They couldn't allow even one to be lost. Morris wandered over to the bridge radar scope and looked down into the rubber eye shield to watch the aircraft lifting out of Dover. Each blip contained 300 to 500 men. What would happen when they ran out of shells? Another merchy skipper. The officer of the deck pointed to a dot on the horizon. She's a Dutch container boat. I expect she's inbound for military cargo. Morris grunted. We need all the help we can get. Sunnyvale, California. It's definite, sir, the colonel said. That's a Soviet ASAT bird, 73 nautical miles behind one of ours. The colonel had ordered his satellite to turn in space and point its cameras at its new companion. The light wasn't all that good, but the shape of the Soviet killer satellite was unmistakable. A cylinder nearly 100 feet long, with a rocket motor at one end and a radar seeker antenna at the other. What's your recommendation, Colonel? Sir, I am requesting unlimited authority to maneuver my birds at will. As soon as anything with a red star on it gets within 50 miles, I'm going to do a series of Delta-V maneuvers to screw up their intercept solution. That will cost you a lot of fuel, son, Sink Norad warned. What we have here, General, is a binary solution set. The colonel responded like a true mathematician. Choice one, we maneuver the birds and risk the fuel loss. Choice two, we don't maneuver the birds and risk having them taken out. Once they close to 50 miles, they can achieve intercept and negate our bird in as little as 5 minutes, maybe faster. 5 minutes is only the best we've observed them to do. Sir, you have my recommendation. The colonel had a Ph.D. in mathematics from the University of Illinois, but that was not where he'd learned to back generals into corners. Okay, this one goes to Washington, but I'll forward your recommendation with my endorsement. USS Nimitz. Admiral, we just had a disturbing report from the Barents Sea. Toland read the dispatch from Sinkland Fleet. How many more subs can they throw at us now? Perhaps as many as 30 additional boats, Admiral. 30? Baker hadn't liked anything he'd been told for a week now. He especially didn't like this. The Nimitz battle group, in company with Saratoga and the French carrier Foch, was escorting a marine amphibious unit, called a Mau, to reinforce the ground defenses on Iceland. A 3-day run. If the war started soon after they made their delivery, their next mission would be to support the GIUK barrier defense plan, the critically important link that covered the ocean between Greenland, Iceland, and the United Kingdom. Carrier Task Force 21 was a powerful force, but would it be powerful enough? Doctrine required a 4-carrier group to fight and survive up here, but the fleet had not yet been fully assembled. Toland was getting reports on frantic diplomatic activity aimed at averting the war that appeared about to start, much as everyone hoped it wouldn't. How would the Soviets react to 4 or more carriers in the Norwegian Sea? It seemed that no one in Washington wanted to find out, but Toland was wondering if it would matter at all. As it was, Iceland had approved the reinforcements they were escorting only 12 hours before, and this NATO outpost needed immediate reinforcement. USS Chicago. McCafferty was 30 miles north of the entrance to the Kola Fjord. The crew was relatively happy to be here after a tense 16-hour run from Cape Svjatoy. Though the Barents Sea was alive with anti-submarine ships, immediately after making their report, they had been withdrawn from the entrance to the White Sea for fear of fomenting a major incident. Here there was 130 fathoms of water and room to maneuver, and they were confident in their ability to keep out of trouble. There was supposed to be a pair of American subs within 50 miles of Chicago, plus a Brit and 2 Norwegian diesel boats. His sonarman couldn't hear any of them, though they could hear a quartet of Grisha-class frigates pinging away at something to the southeast. The Allied submarines here were assigned to watch and listen. It was a nearly ideal mission for them, since they only had to creep along, avoiding contact with surface ships, which they could detect from a good, long distance. There was no hiding it now. McCafferty didn't even consider not telling his men the significance of what they had learned about the Russian boomers. Submarines have no long-lived secrets. It looked like they were about to fight a war. The politicians in Washington and the strategists in Norfolk and elsewhere might still have their doubts. But there, at the sharp end of the lance, the officers and men aboard Chicago discussed the way the Soviets were using their ships and came up with a single answer. The submarine's torpedo tubes were loaded with MK-48 torpedoes and harpoon missiles. Her vertical missile tubes forward of the pressure hull held 12 Tomahawks, 3 nuclear-tipped land-attack missiles, and 9 conventional anti-ship models. When a shipboard machine showed the first suggestion of a fault, a technician immediately tore it down to fix it. McCafferty was pleased and not a little surprised by his crew. So young they were. The average age on his submarine was 21. To have to adapt to this. He stood in the sonar room, forward and starboard of the attack center. A few feet from him, a massive computer system sifted through an avalanche of waterborne sound, analyzing individual frequency bands known from experience to mark the acoustical signature of a Soviet vessel. The signals were displayed on a visual screen called a waterfall display, a monocolor curtain of yellow whose brighter lines indicated the bearing to a sound that might be a source of interest. 4 lines indicated the Grishas, and offset dots marked the pings from their active sonars. McCafferty wondered what they were after. His interest was mainly academic. They weren't pinging his ship, but there was always something to learn from how the enemy did his job. A team of officers in the attack center was plotting the movement of the Soviet patrol ships, carefully noting their formation patterns and hunting technique for later comparison with intelligence estimates. A new series of dots appeared at the bottom of the screen. A sonarman punched a button for a more selective frequency setting, altering the display slightly, then plugged in a pair of microphones. The display was on fast-speed image generation, and McCafferty saw the dots grow to lines around bearing 198, the direction to the Kola Channel. "Lots of confused noise, Skipper," the sonarman reported. "I read Alphas and Charlies coming out, with other stuff behind them. Blade count on one Alpha is something like 30 knots. Lots of noise behind them, sir." The visual display confirmed it a minute later. The frequency or tone lines were in the areas known to depict specific classes of submarines, all moving at high speed to clear the harbor. The bearing to contact lines spread apart as the boats fanned out. The boats had already dived, he noted. Usually, Soviet submarines didn't dive until they were well offshore.
"Ship count is over 20, sir," the chief sonarman said quietly. "We have a major sortie here."
"Sure looks like it."
McCafferty moved back to the attack center. His men were already entering the contact positions into the fire control computer and sketching paper tracks on the chart table. The war hadn't started yet, and though it appeared it could come at any time, McCafferty's orders were to keep clear of any Soviet formation until the word came.
He didn't like it. Better to get his blows in quick.
But Washington had made it clear they wanted no one to cause an incident that might prevent some kind of diplomatic settlement.
That made sense, the captain admitted to himself.
Maybe the lace-panty folks could still get things under control.
A faint hope, but a real one.
Real enough to overcome his tactical desire to hold an attack position. He ordered his submarine moved farther offshore. In half an hour, things were clearer still, and the captain had a slot buoy launched. The buoy was programmed to allow Chicago 30 minutes to clear the area. Then it started sending a series of burst transmissions on a UHF satellite band. From 10 miles away, he listened to Soviet ships going berserk around the radio buoy, doubtlessly thinking it was the location of the submarine. The game was becoming all too real. The buoy operated for over an hour, continuously sending its data to a NATO communications satellite. By nightfall, the data was being broadcast to all NATO units at sea. The Russians are coming. Chapter 16. Last Moves, First Moves. USS Nimitz. The speaker had announced sunset 2 hours before, but Bob had to finish his work. Sunsets at sea far away from the polluted city air, with a sharp horizon for the sun to slide under, were always something he enjoyed watching. What he saw now was almost as good. He stood with his hands on the rail, first looking down at the foam alongside the carrier's sleek hull. Then, after a brief moment of preparation, up. Born and raised in Boston, Toland hadn't known what the Milky Way was until joining the Navy. And the discovery of the wide, bright belt of stars overhead was always a source of wonder to him. There were the stars he'd learned to navigate by, with sextants and trigonometric tables, largely replaced now by electronic aids like Omega and Loran. But they were still beautiful to behold. Arcturus and Vega and Altair, all blinking at him with their own colors, their own unique characteristics that made them benchmarks in the night sky. A door opened, and a sailor dressed in what looked like a purple plain fueler's shirt joined him on the flight deck catwalk.
"Darkened ship, sailor. I'd dump that cigarette," Toland said sharply, more annoyed to have his precious solitude destroyed.
"Sorry, sir." The butt sailed over the side. The man was silent for a few minutes, then looked at Toland.
"You know about the star, sir?"
"What do you mean?"
"This is my first cruise, sir, and I grew up in New York. Never saw the stars like this, but I don't even know what they are. The names, I mean. You officers know all that stuff, right?"
Toland laughed quietly.
"I know what you mean. Same with my first time out. Pretty, isn't it?"
"Yes, sir."
"What's that one?"
The boy's voice sounded tired. Small wonder, Toland thought, with all the flight operations they've been through today. The youngster pointed to the brightest dot in the eastern sky, and Bob had to think for a few seconds.
That's Jupiter, a planet, not a star.
With the quartermaster's spyglass, you can pick out her moons. Some of them, anyway. He went on to point out some of the stars used for navigation.
How do you use them, sir? The sailor asked.
You take a sextant and plot their height above the horizon. Sounds harder than it is, just takes some practice. And you check that against a book of star positions.
Who does that, sir?
The book?
Standard stuff.
I imagine the book we use comes from the Naval Observatory in D.C., but people have been measuring the tracks of the stars and planets for 3,000 or 4,000 years, long before telescopes were invented. Anyway, if you know the exact time, and you know where a particular star is, you can plot out where you are on the globe pretty accurately, within a few hundred yards if you really know your stuff. Same thing with the sun and the moon. That knowledge has been around for hundreds of years. The tricky part was inventing a clock that kept good time. That happened about 200 and some years ago. I thought they used satellites and stuff like that.
We do now, but the stars are just as pretty.
Yeah. The sailor sat down, his head leaning way back to watch the curtain of white points. Beneath them the ship's hull churned the water to foam with the whispering sound of a continuously breaking wave. Somehow the sound and the sky matched each other perfectly.
Well, at least I learned something about the stars.
When's it gonna start, sir?
Toland looked up at the constellation of Sagittarius. The center of the galaxy was behind it. Some astrophysicists said there was a black hole in there. The most destructive force known to physics, it made the forces under man's control appear puny by comparison. But men were a lot easier to destroy.
Soon.
USS Chicago. The submarine was far offshore now, west of the surging Soviet submarine and surface forces. They'd heard no explosions yet, but it couldn't be far off. The nearest Soviet ship was about 30 miles off to the east, and a dozen more were plotted. All were blasting the sea with their active sonars. McCafferty was surprised by his flash operational order. Chicago was being pulled out of the Barents Sea and shifted to a patrol area in the Norwegian Sea. Mission? To interdict Soviet submarines expected to head south toward the North Atlantic. A political decision had been made. It must not appear that NATO was forcing the Soviets into a war. In a stroke, the pre-war strategy of engaging the Soviet fleet in its own backyard had been tossed away. Like every pre-war battle plan in this century, the sub-skipper reflected, this one, too, was being torn up, because the enemy wasn't going to cooperate and do what we'd thought he'd do. Of course. He was putting many more submarines in the Atlantic than had been expected. Even worse, we were making it easier for him. McCafferty wondered what other surprises were in store. The submarine's torpedoes and missiles were now fully armed, her fire control systems continuously manned, her crew standing Condition 3 wartime watch routine. But their orders at present were to run away. The captain swore to himself, angry with whoever had made this decision, yet still hoping in a quiet corner of his mind that somehow the war could be stopped. Brussels, Belgium.
It's gotta happen soon, Comair Sant observed. Shit, they got their troops as ready as I've ever seen. They can't wait until all our reforger units are fully in place. They have to hit us soon.
I know what you're saying, Charlie, but we can't move first.
Any word on our visitors? The Air Force General referred to Major Chernyavin's team of Spetsnaz commandos.
Still sitting tight.
A unit of the elite GSG-9 German border guards
had the safe house under continuous surveillance, with a second English ambush team between them and their supposed target in Lammersdorf. Intelligence officers from most of the NATO countries were part of the surveillance team, each with a direct line to his government.
What if they're bait, trying to get us to strike first?
I know we can't do that, General. What I want is a green light to initiate Dreamland when we know it's all for real. We have to get our licks in fast, boss.
Sakyr leaned back. Trapped by his duties in his underground command post, he hadn't been to his official residence in 10 days. He wondered if any general officer in the whole world had gotten any sleep in the past 2 weeks.
If you put the orders up, how fast can you react?
I have all the birds loaded and ready now. My crews are briefed. If I order them to stand to, I can have Dreamland running 30 minutes from your signal.
Okay, Charlie. The President has given me authority to react to any attack. Tell your people to stand to.
Right.
Sakyr's phone rang. He lifted it, listened briefly, and looked up.
Our visitors are moving, he told Comair Sent.
To his operations officer.
The code word is Firelight.
NATO forces would now go to maximum alert. Aachen, Federal Republic of Germany. The Spetsnaz team left the safe house in 2 small vans and drove south on the road to Lammersdorf. With their leader killed in a traffic accident, the second in command, a captain, had been delivered copies of the papers his boss had died to get, and fully briefed his men. They were quiet and tense. The officer had taken pains to explain to his men that their escape had been carefully planned. That once clear of the target, they'd get to another safe house and wait for their Red Army comrades to arrive in 5 days. They were the cream of the Red Army, he'd told them, thoroughly trained to carry out dangerous missions behind enemy lines, hence valuable to the state. Every man had combat experience fighting in the mountains of Afghanistan, he reminded them. They were trained. They were ready. The men accepted this speech, as elite troopers usually did, in total silence. Chosen most of all for their intelligence, each of them knew that the speech was merely that. The mission depended largely on luck, and their luck had already gone bad. Every one of them wished that Major Chernyavin were there, and wondered if somehow the mission might have been blown. One by one, they set these thoughts aside. Soon every man was reviewing his part in the mission to destroy Lammersdorf. The drivers were KGB agents well experienced at working in foreign lands, and wondering exactly the same thing. Both vehicles stayed together, driving conservatively, wary of vehicles that followed them. Each had a scanner radio tuned to the local police frequencies, and another for communicating with each other. The KGB officers had discussed the mission an hour before. Moscow Center had told them that NATO was not yet fully alerted. The lead driver, whose regular cover job was driving a taxi, wondered if a full NATO alert meant a parade through Red Square.
Turning right now. Car 3, close in. Car 1, turn left at the next intersection and get ahead of them.
Colonel Weber spoke over a tactical radio of the sort used by FIST, fire support team, units. The ambush had been ready for several days now, and as soon as their targets had emerged from their safe house, the word had been flashed all over the Federal Republic. NATO establishments already on alert were brought to full battle readiness. This could only be the opening move in a shooting war. Unless, Weber admitted to himself, they were simply moving from one secure place to wait further in another one. He didn't know which way things would turn, though surely it had to begin soon. Didn't it? The two trucks were now in a rural part of western Germany, driving southeast through the German-Belgian Nature Park, a scenic route often traveled by tourists and sightseers.
They had chosen this side road to avoid the military traffic on the major highways. But as they passed through Mulart Shuta, the lead driver frowned as he saw a military convoy of tanks on low-hauler trailers. Strangely, the tanks were loaded backwards, with their massive guns facing aft. British tanks, he saw. New Challengers. Well, he hadn't expected to see any German Leopard tanks on the Belgian border. There had never been any possibility of preventing a German mobilization, and he tried to convince himself that the rest of the NATO countries had not moved as quickly as they could have. Ah, if this mission were successful, then NATO's communications would be seriously damaged, and maybe the armored spearheads would indeed come to rescue them. The convoy slowed. The driver considered pulling around them, but his orders were to be inconspicuous. "Everyone ready?" Weber asked from his chase car. "Ready." Bloody complex op, this, Colonel Armstrong thought. Tankers, SAS, and the Germans all working together. But worth it to bag a bunch of Spetsnaz. The convoy slowed and stopped at a picnicking area. Weber halted his car 100 meters away. It was now in the hands of the English ambush team. Flares erupted around the two small vans. The KGB driver cringed at being in the center of so much light. Then he looked forward to see the barrel of the tank just 50 meters ahead of him rise from its travel rest and center on his windshield. "Attention," a voice called in Russian over a megaphone. "Spetsnaz soldiers, attention. You are surrounded by a company of mechanized troops. Come out of your vehicles singly and unarmed. If you open fire, you will be killed within seconds." A second voice began speaking. "Come out, comrades. This is Major Chernyavin. There is no chance." The commandos exchanged looks of horror. In the lead vehicle, the captain started to pull the pin on a grenade. A sergeant leaped on him and wrapped his hand around the captain's. "We cannot be taken alive. Those are our orders," the captain shouted. "The devil's mother, we can't," the sergeant screamed. "One at a time, comrades. Out with hands high, and be careful." A private emerged from the back door of the van, one slow foot at a time. "Come to the sound of my voice, Ivanov," Chernyavin said from a wheelchair. The major had told much to earn the chance to save his detachment. He had worked with these men for 2 years, and he could not let them be slaughtered to no purpose. It was one thing to be loyal to the state, another to be loyal to the men he'd led in combat operations. "You will not be hurt. If you have any weapons, drop them now. I know about the knife you carry, Private Ivanov." "Very good. Next man." It went quickly. A joint team of Special Air Service and GSG-9 commandos collected their Soviet counterparts, handcuffed them, and led them off to be blindfolded. Soon only two were left. The grenade made it tricky. By this time the captain had seen the futility of his action, but it proved impossible to locate the pin for the grenade. The sergeant shouted a warning to Chernyavin, who wanted to come forward himself, but couldn't. The captain came out last. He wanted to throw the grenade at the officer who, he thought, had betrayed his country, only to see a man whose legs were swathed in plaster. Chernyavin could see the look on the man's face. "Andrei Ilyich, would you prefer that your life should end for nothing?" the major asked. "The bastards drugged me and learned enough to kill you all. I could not let them do this."
"I have a live grenade," the captain said loudly. "I will throw it into the truck." This he did before anyone could shout to stop him. A moment later the truck exploded, destroying the group's maps and plans for escape. For the first time in a week, Chernyavin's face broke into a wide grin. "Well done, Andrushka." 2 other Spetsnaz groups were less lucky, and were intercepted within sight of their targets by German units privy to Chernyavin's capture.
but 20 additional groups were in the Federal Republic, and not every NATO site had gotten the word in time. A score of vicious firefights erupted on both sides of the Rhine. A war to involve millions began with squad and platoon-sized units fighting desperate actions in the dark. Chapter 17 The Frisbees of Dreamland. Germany, forward edge of the battle area. The view would have been frightening to most men. There were solid clouds overhead at 4,000 feet. He flew through showers that he more heard than saw on this black night, and the dark outlines of trees appeared to reach up and snatch at his speeding fighter. Only a madman would be so low on such a night. So much the better, he smiled inside his oxygen mask. Colonel Douglas Ellington's fingertips caressed the control stick of his F-19A Ghost Rider attack fighter, while his other hand rested on the side-by-side throttle controls on the left side cockpit wall. The head-up display, projected on the windshield in front of him, reported 625 knots indicated airspeed, 106 feet of altitude, a heading of 013, and around the numbers was a monocular holographic image of the terrain before him. The image came from a forward-looking infrared camera in the fighter's nose, augmented by an invisible laser that interrogated the ground 8 times per second. For peripheral vision, his oversized helmet was fitted with low-light goggles.
"Raising hell over our heads," his backseater reported.
Major Don Isley monitored the radio and radar signals, as well as their own instruments.
"All systems continue nominal, range to target now 90 miles.
"Right," the Duke responded. It had been an automatic nickname for Ellington, who even looked vaguely like the jazz musician. Ellington relished the mission. They were skimming north at perilously low level over the angular terrain of East Germany, and their Frisbee, never more than 200 feet off the ground, jerked up and down to the pilot's constant course adjustments. Lockheed called her the Ghost Rider. The pilots called her the Frisbee, the F-19A, the secretly developed stealth attack fighter. She had no corners, no box shapes to allow radar signals to bounce cleanly off her. Her high-bypass turbofans were designed to emit a blurry infrared signature at most. From above, her wings appeared to mimic the shape of a cathedral bell. From in front, they curved oddly toward the ground, earning her the affectionate nickname of Frisbee. Though she was a masterpiece of electronic technology inside, she usually didn't use her active systems. Radars and radios made electronic noise that an enemy might detect. And the whole idea of the Frisbee was that she didn't seem to exist at all. Far over their heads on both sides of the border, hundreds of fighter aircraft played a deadly game of bluff, racing toward the border and then turning away, both sides trying to goad the other into committing to battle. Each side had airborne radar aircraft with which to control such a battle, and so gain the advantage in a war which, though few yet knew it, had already begun.
"And we're getting a quick one in," Ellington thought. "We're finally doing something smart."
He'd had 100 missions over Vietnam in the first production F-111A fighters. The Duke was the Air Force's leading expert on covert low-level missions, and it was said that he could bullseye a chuck hole in a Kansas tornado at midnight. That wasn't quite true. The Frisbee could never handle a tornado. The sad truth was that the F-19 handled like a pig, a consequence of her ungainly design. But Ellington didn't care. Being invisible was better than being agile, he judged, knowing that he was about to prove or disprove that proposition. The Frisbee squadron was now penetrating the most concentrated SAM belt the world had ever known.
"Range to primary target is now 60 miles, Isley advised. "All onboard systems continue nominal. No radars are locked onto us. Looking good, Duke.
Roger. Ellington pushed the stick forward and dived as they passed over the crest of a small hill, then bottomed out at 80 feet over a wheat field. The Duke was playing his game to the limit, drawing on years of experience in low-level attacks. Their primary target was a Soviet IL-76 mainstay, an AWACS-type aircraft that was circling near Magdeburg, agreeably within 10 miles of their secondary target, the E-8 highway bridges over the Elbe at Hohenroarte. The mission was getting a lot hairier. The closer they got to the mainstay, the more radar signal hit their aircraft, its intensity growing at a square function. Sooner or later, enough signal would be reflected back to the mainstay to be detectable, even by curved wings made of radar-transparent composites. All the stealth technology did was to make radar detection harder, not impossible. Would they be seen by the mainstay? If so, when? And how quickly would the Russians react?
"Keep her on the deck," he told himself. "Play the game by the rules you've practiced out."
They had rehearsed this mission for 9 days in Dreamland, the top-secret exercise area in the sprawl of Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada. Even the E-3A Sentry could barely make them out at 40 miles, and the Sentry was a far better radar platform than the mainstay, wasn't it?
"That's what you're here to find out, boy."
There were 5 mainstays on duty, all 100 clicks east of the inter-German border. A nice, safe distance, what with over 300 fighters between them and the border.
20 miles, Duke."
"Right.
Call it off, Don."
"Raj, still no fire control emanations on us, and no search stuff is lingering our way. Lots of radio chatter, but mostly west of us. Very little vox coming from the target."
Ellington reached his left hand down to arm the 4 AIM-9M Sidewinder missiles hanging under his wings. The weapon indicator light blinked a lethal, friendly green. 18 miles, target appears to be circling normally, not taking evasive action.
10 miles to the minute, Ellington computed in his mind. 1 minute, 40 seconds.
16 miles.
Isley read the numbers off a computer readout keyed to the Navstar satellite navigation system. The mainstay would not have a chance. The Frisbee would not begin to climb until she was directly underneath the target. 14 miles. 12, 10, 8. 6 miles to the converted air transport.
"The mainstay just reversed her turn."
"Yeah, she's jinking.
A foxfire just swept over us," Isley said evenly.
A MiG-25 interceptor, presumably acting on instructions from the IL-76, was now searching for them. With its high power and small arc, the foxfire stood a good chance of acquiring them, stealth technology or not.
"The mainstay might have us."
"Anything locked on us?"
"Not yet."
Isley's eyes were glued to the threat receiver instruments. No missile control radars had centered on the Frisbee yet.
"Coming under the target."
"Right.
Climbing now."
Ellington eased back on his stick and punched up full afterburners. The Frisbee's engines could only give him Mach 1.3, but this was the place to use all the power he had. According to the weather people, these clouds topped out at 20,000 feet, and the IL-76 would be about 5,000 above that. Now the Frisbee was vulnerable. No longer lost in the ground clutter, her engines radiating their maximum signature, the stealth aircraft was broadcasting her presence.
"Climb faster, baby."
"Tally-ho!"
Ellington said too loudly over the intercom as he burst through the clouds. And the night vision systems instantly showed him the mainstay, 5 miles away and diving for cover in front of him.
Too late.
The head-on closing speed was nearly 1,000 miles per hour. The colonel centered his gun sight pipper on the target. A warbling tone came into his headset. The Sidewinder seekers had locked onto the target. His right thumb toggled the launch enable switch, and his forefinger squeezed the trigger twice. The Sidewinders left the aircraft half a second apart. Their brilliant exhaust flames dazzled him,
but he did not take his eyes off the missiles as they raced for the target. It took 8 seconds. He looked them all the way in. Both missiles angled for the mainstay's starboard wing. 30 feet away, laser proximity fuses detonated, filling the air with lethal fragments. It happened too fast. Both of the mainstay's right-side engines exploded, the wing came off, and the Soviet aircraft began cartwheeling violently downward, lost seconds later in the clouds.
Jesus, Ellington thought as he rolled and dived back to the ground and safety. Nothing like the movies. The target was hit and gone between blinks. Well, okay, that was easy enough. Primary target gone. Now for the hard part.
Aboard an E-3A Sentry circling over Strasbourg, the radar technicians noted with satisfaction that all 5 Soviet radar craft had been killed within 2 minutes. It all worked. The F-19 really did surprise them. The Brigadier General in command of Operation Dreamland leaned forward in his command chair and toggled his microphone.
"Trumpeter, trumpeter, trumpeter," he said, then switched off.
"Okay, boys," he breathed, "make it count."
Amid the clouds of NATO tactical fighters hovering near the border, 100 low-level attack fighters broke clear and dove for the ground. Half were F-111F Aardvarks, the other half GR-1 Tornadoes, their wings heavy with fuel tanks and smart bombs. They followed the second wave of Frisbees, already 60 miles into East Germany, fanning out to their ground targets. Behind the strike aircraft, all-weather Eagle and Phantom interceptors, directed by the sentries circling over the Rhine, began to launch their radar-guided missiles at Soviet fighters that had just lost their airborne controllers. Finally, a third team of NATO aircraft swooped in low, seeking out the ground radar sites that were coming on to replace the radar coverage of the dead mainstays. Hohenroarte, German Democratic Republic. Ellington circled his target at 1,000 feet, several miles away. It was a double bridge, a pair of concrete arches, each about 500 yards across, and with 2 traffic lanes that crossed the River Elbe in the middle of a gentle S-curve. Pretty bridges. Ellington guessed that they dated back to the '30s, since this main road from Berlin to Braunschweig had been one of the first autobahns.
"Old Adolf himself might have driven across these bridges," Ellington reflected. "So much the better."
At the moment, a low-light television in his targeting systems showed them to be covered with Russian T-80 tanks all heading west. Ellington evaluated the picture on his television screen. This could only be the second echelon of the army deployed to attack NATO. There was an SA-6 battery atop Hill 76, south of the bridges on the east bank, sited there to defend them. It had to be fully alert now. His earphones chirped constantly with noise from his threat receiver as the search radars from a score of air defense batteries swept continuously over his aircraft. If only one of them got a good return... "Pucker factor," Ellington reflected grimly.
"How's the pave tack?"
"Nominal," Isley responded curtly. Pilot and backseater were both under enormous stress.
"Illuminate," Ellington ordered.
In the back seat, Isley activated the pave tack target illumination laser. The elaborate pave tack gear was built into the Frisbee's drooping nose cone. Its lowermost part was a rotating turret containing a carbon dioxide laser and television camera. The major used his joystick controls to center the TV picture on the bridge, then unmasked the infrared laser. An invisible dot appeared in the center of the North Span's bridge deck. A computer system would keep it there until told to do otherwise, and a videotape recorder would make a visual record of the raid's success or failure.
"The target is lit," Isley said. "Still no fire control radars on us."
"Nemo, this is Shade 4. The target is lit."
"Rog."
15 seconds later, the first aardvark screamed south a bare 30 feet over the water, popped up, and loosed a single GBU-15 Paveway laser-guided bomb before it turned hard to the east over Hohenroarta. An optical computer system in the bomb's nose noted the reflected infrared beam, centered it, and adjusted the fins accordingly. South of the bridge, the SAM battery commander was trying to decide what the noise was. His search radar did not show the Frisbee. He had been told not to expect the presence of friendly aircraft. The safe travel lane was 15 miles to the north, over the frontal aviation base at Malminkel.
Maybe that's where the noise was coming from, he thought. No special alarm has been sent out.
The northern horizon went bright yellow. Though he did not know it, 4 Luftwaffe tornadoes had just made a single pass over Malminkel, leaving hundreds of explosive cluster munitions in their wake. A half-dozen Soviet Sukhoi attack fighters went up in flames, sending a fireball of jet fuel that rose up into the rain-filled sky. The battery commander hesitated not at all. He shouted an order for his men to switch their fire control radars from standby to active, and trace them around their bridges. A moment later, one detected an F-111 coming upriver.
Oh, shit!
The aardvark's systems operator instantly loosed a Shrike anti-radar missile at the SAM battery, another for good measure at the search radar, a second Paveway at the bridge. Then the F-111 turned violently left. A missile launch officer blanched as he realized what had just appeared from nowhere under his scopes, and salvoed his 3 missiles in return. The incoming aircraft had to be hostile, and had just separated 3 smaller objects. His first SAM struck and exploded on the high-tension power lines that spanned the river just south of the bridges. The entire valley was strobe-lighted as the power lines fell sparking into the river. The other 2 SAMs raced past the surreal explosion and locked onto the second F-111. The first Paveway impacted precisely in the center of the northern span. It was a delayed-action bomb, and penetrated into the thick concrete before exploding a few yards from a battalion commander's tank. The north span was strong. It had been in use for over 50 years. But the 945 pounds of high explosive ripped it apart. In an instant, the graceful concrete arch was cut in two, a ragged 20-foot gap appearing between the 2 unsecured flying buttresses. They were not designed to stand alone, particularly with armored vehicles rumbling over them. The bomb released by the second aardvark struck closer to shore, and the eastern side of the span failed entirely, taking 8 tanks into the elbow with it. The second F-111 did not live to see this, however. One of the racing SA-6 missiles struck it broadside and blew it to pieces 3 seconds after the aircraft-launched Shrikes obliterated the pair of Soviet radar vehicles. Neither side had time for grief. Another F-111 screamed upriver as the surviving SAM crews frantically searched for targets. 30 seconds later, the north span was totally destroyed. Brick-sized chunks of ferro-concrete scattered on the river bottom from 3 smart bomb impacts. Isley switched his laser designator to the south span. It was clogged with tanks, log-jammed by a BMP-1 personnel carrier blown whole from one bridge span to the other by the first bomb, torn asunder and blazing on the west end of the bridge. The fourth aardvark lofted a pair of bombs which homed in remorselessly on the laser spot now stuck on the turret of a stopped tank. The sky was alight with blazing diesel fuel and streaked with hand-launched SAMs that had been blind-fired by panicked riflemen. Both Paveways exploded a scant 10 feet apart, and the entire bridge span failed at once, dropping a company of armored vehicles into the Elbe.
One more thing to do, Ellington told himself. There.
The Soviets had stockpiled bridging equipment on the secondary road paralleling the river. The engineers were probably nearby. The Frisbee screeched over the rows of trucks, each of which carried a section of ribbon bridge, and deployed a row of flares before skimming back west toward the Federal Republic of Germany and safety.
The three surviving aardvarks came in one at a time, each dropping a pair of rockeye canisters into the truck park, ripping the bridging equipment to bits, and, their pilots fervently hoped, killing some of the skilled bridging engineers as well. Then the aardvarks turned west to follow the F-19 home. By this time, a second team of F-15 Eagle fighters had darted into East Germany to clear four lanes for the returning NATO strike aircraft. They fired their radar and infrared-guided missiles at the MiGs, trying to vector toward the returning fighter bombers. But the American fighters still had their aerial radars to direct them, and the Soviets did not. The results reflected it. The Soviet fighters had not had time to reorganize after the loss of the mainstays, and their formations were savaged. Even worse, the SAM batteries that were supposed to support the MiGs were ordered to engage the invading aircraft, and the surface-to-air missiles began to pluck targets out of the sky entirely without discrimination as the NATO aircraft clung to the nap of the earth. By the time the last aircraft recrossed the border into West Germany, Operation Dreamland had lasted a total of 27 minutes. It had been a costly mission. Two of the priceless Frisbees and 11 strike aircraft had been lost. Yet it had been a success. Over 200 Soviet all-weather fighters had been destroyed by the NATO fighters, and perhaps 100 more by friendly SAMs. The most elite squadrons of the Soviet Air Defense Force had been brutalized, and because of it, for the time being, NATO would own the night skies over Europe. 36 major bridges had been targeted, 30 had been destroyed, and all of the rest damaged. The initial Soviet ground attack, scheduled to begin in 2 hours, would not be supported by the second echelon, nor by specialty units of mobile SAMs, engineers, and other crucial late arrivals fresh from special training in the Soviet homeland. Finally, the attacks against airfields would give NATO air parity, at least for the moment. The NATO air forces had fulfilled their most crucial mission. The much-feared Soviet ground superiority was decisively reduced. The land battle for Western Europe would now be fought on nearly even terms. USS Farris. It was still the previous day on the American East Coast. USS Farris led the way out of the Delaware at 2200 hours. Behind her was a convoy of 30 ships, with a dozen escorting vessels. In both cases, it was all that could be assembled on the short notice. Dozens of American and foreign flag vessels were racing to American ports, many taking southerly routings to keep as far away as possible from the Soviet submarines reported surging south from the Norwegian Sea. The first few days would be tough, Morris knew.
Captain, please come to communications, the announcing system squawked.
Morris immediately went aft to the always locked radio room.
It's for real.
The communications officer handed him the yellow message form. Morris read it in the dim lights.
Zulu 0357 Zulu 15 June from Saklant to all Saklant ships, top secret. 1. Execute unrestricted air and sea warfare against Warsaw Pact forces. 2. War plan Golf TAC 7. 3. Stout Hearts. Saklant sends.
Rules of Engagement, War Option 7. That meant no nukes, he was perfectly happy to see. Farris didn't have any at the moment. He was now free to engage without warning any East Bloc warship or merchant vessel.
Well, Morris nodded.
He tucked the message form into his pocket, returned to the bridge, and went without a word to the microphone.
This is the captain speaking. Listen up. It's official. We are now in a shooting war. No more drills, gentlemen. If you hear an alarm from now on, it means there's a bad guy out there, and they have live weapons, too. That is all.
He hung up and looked over to the officer of the deck.
Mr. Johnson, I want the Prairie Masker systems operating continuously. If they go down, I want to know about it at once. That goes in the order book.
Aye, Captain.
Prairie Masker was a system for defeating submarine sonars. Two metallic bands surrounded the frigate's hull, fore and aft of the engine spaces. This was Masker. It took compressed air and bled it into the water around the ship in the form of millions of tiny bubbles. The prairie part of the system did the same with the propeller blades. The air bubbles created a semi-permeable barrier that tended to trap sounds made by the ship, letting only a fraction of her propulsion noises escape, which made the ship extremely difficult for a submarine to detect.
"How long till we clear the channel?" Morris asked. "We'll be at the sea buoy in 90 minutes.
"Okay, tell the bosun's mate of the watch to be ready to steam the tail and the Nixie," the towed array sonar and the Nixie torpedo decoy, "at 23:45. I'm going to take a nap. Wake me at 23:30. Anything happens, call me."
"Aye, aye, sir."
A trio of P-3C Orion anti-submarine aircraft swept the area ahead of them. The only hazard was that of normal navigation. And suddenly the prospect of grazing the bottom or smashing an errant buoy looked like a minor affair. He'd need his sleep now, Morris knew. And he would not be at all surprised to find a submarine waiting right on the continental shelf in 3 hours. He'd want to be rested for that eventuality.
Sunnyvale, California.
What was holding Washington up? The colonel asked himself. All he needed was a simple yes or no. He checked his boards. 3 KH-type photo-reconnaissance satellites were currently in orbit, plus 9 electronic surveillance birds. That was his low-level constellation. He didn't fear for his higher-flying navigation and communication satellites, but the 12 in low-Earth orbit, especially the KHs, were valuable and vulnerable. Two of them had Russian killer sats in close proximity, and one of his birds was now approaching Soviet territory, with another only 40 minutes behind. The third keyhole bird didn't have a satellite assigned yet, but the last pass over Leninsk showed another F-type booster being fueled on the pad.
"Take another look at the trailer," he ordered.
A technician made the requisite commands, and half a world away the satellite fired its attitude control thrusters and pivoted in space to allow its cameras to search for the Russian killer satellite. It had held position 50 miles behind and 9 miles below the American satellite, but now was gone.
"They moved it. They moved it in the last half hour."
He lifted the phone to tell Sync NORAD that he was moving the satellite on his own authority.
"Too late."
As the satellite turned again to point its cameras at the ground, a cylindrical mass covered a sizable percentage of the Earth's face. There was a flash, and the TV screen went blank. Just like that.
"Chris, you have those maneuver commands set up?"
"Yes, sir," the captain answered, still staring at the screen.
"Execute them right now."
The captain called up the command sequence on his computer console and punched enter. The colonel's phone rang as the satellite's onboard rocket motors made subtle changes in their orbital paths.
"Argus Control," the colonel answered.
"This is Sync NORAD. What the hell happened?"
"That Russian killer sat closed and detonated. We have no signal from the KH-11, sir. I must assume they have successfully negated the bird. I've just ordered the other two keyholes to make 100 foot per second Delta-5. Tell Washington they waited too long, sir."
Chapter 18. Polar Glory. Kiev, the Ukraine. It had been decided that all Soviet theater and front commanders would be briefed on developments in Germany. Alexeyev and his superior knew why. If anyone were to be relieved from his command, the new man would have to know the situation. They listened to the intelligence report with fascination. Neither of them had expected many of the Spetsnaz attacks to fare well, but it seemed that some had been successful, especially those in the German ports. Then the operational intelligence brief got to the bridges on the Elbe.
"Why weren't we warned about this?" Sink Southwest demanded.
"Comrade General," the Air Force officer responded, "our information was that this stealth aircraft was a prototype, not yet in regular service.
Somehow the Americans have managed to construct a number of them, at least part of a squadron. They used it to eliminate our airborne radar coverage, thus paving the way for a massive penetration raid against our airfields and lines of supply, plus a well-planned air